You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 28th of March 2018 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller on today's show.
But Donald Trump kind of makes it click in your head that this actually has a much wider impact. I don't think that military-style information operations is conducive for any democratic process, whether it's a US presidential or a local council race.
Cambridge Analytica's Christopher Wiley continues blowing his whistle. Is it really possible that a shady data firm might have tipped two of the most important votes of our time? My guests Joy Lodico and Sebastian Borger will be discussing this and the day's other top stories, including the continuing travails of Catalonia's runaway government, Article 50 Day, as it seems unlikely to become celebrated. Tomorrow is the first. And is there a good reason why a national census shouldn't ask about your citizenship? Some Americans believe so. That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24. So, welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Joy Lodico, columnist with the Evening Standard, and Sebastian Borger, London correspondent for Berliner Zeitung. Welcome both. We will start tonight with the latest peregrinations of the exiled would-be government of an independent Catalonia. Clara Ponsati, former councillor of education in Catalonia's regional government, has been released on bail by a court in Scotland after answering a European arrest warrant issued by Spain, which accuses her of rebellion. This follows the weekend's arrest in Germany of Catalonia's former leader, Carles Puigdemont, which prompted demonstrations in Barcelona and elsewhere. Mr. Puigdemont remains in custody. Spain is seeking the arrest and extradition of several other former Catalonian ministers. Sebastian, first of all, if they have broken the law, shouldn't Spain pursue them?
Well, what law have they broken?
The one about rebellion and sedition and so forth.
It's pretty serious. Well, no, sorry, it isn't. It's a very serious problem. It's not a very serious problem for the courts. It's a very serious problem for Spanish politics. And if they can't get into a dialogue with these people, then they will actually, the Madrid government, they will actually make the Catalans separate, which they don't, as we know, still the majority of Catalans is not interested in it.
Indeed not.
It is finely balanced, but they have enough common sense to not to want it. But if Madrid keeps behaving like that, it really is completely stupid. And I mean, apart from that I find the German police idiotic, that someone should have just been to the toilet, or the computer should have broken down. I mean, come on. Last time I looked, Finland, Sweden and Denmark are all in the European Union. Who is the idiot who actually puts him away? Germany. Typical.
This is the Germans not crossing on a don't walk signal, isn't it?
Yeah.
Joy, is there, in fact, a political argument, as Sebastian suggests, that the law being the law, fine, but Spain, in the interests of a quiet life, should actually just drop this? Because this actually, I mean, it would be annoying and unpleasant for the Catalonian ministers to be pursued, harassed, and indeed locked up. But this does kind of work for them, doesn't it?
Well, the arguments that are going around this are all about the rule of law. And in fact, this has all been devolved to the Spanish Supreme Court, who have decided that there are indeed charges that you can bring against these people. So the minute you start saying, well, the Supreme Court can't bring these charges, that undermines the rule of law there. The minute you start saying that they can't be arrested in Germany, that undermines the rule of law there. So is it politics? Is it rule of law? Does the rule of law, in fact, last longer than politics? Should you, in fact, go by the playbook? There's another kind of nice little wrinkle in this, which is the rule of law in Spain is not applied in the same way as in Germany. So, in fact, there are all these arguments saying that the European arrest warrant, based on the terms that Spain has applied for it, don't actually work in Germany. So rebellion doesn't count. So Germany can only send... Germany is not part of the European arrest warrant. High treason, that doesn't work either. Mm. The only thing you can get him on is the Al Capone, is money and embezzlement. So at which point it does become quite minor, and it becomes kind of a laughing stock if the only reason the Spanish can get him back is is cash.
Well, in fact, isn't it the case that the investigating judge who first put out a European arrest warrant against Puigdemont withdrew that as soon as he saw that Belgium would not extradite him on the so-called rebellion, but they might possibly extradite him on some minor fraud, you know, embezzlement, whatever you call it. I mean, which is really, makes Madrid a laughing stock.
That in itself would also have the effect of making Puigdemont something of a laughing stock, because being extradited and brought home clapped in irons on charges of rebellion and high treason, that is pretty badass. But if you get extradited and brought home on charges of cooking the books, you look a little bit ridiculous.
Okay, well, let's see. I can tell you one thing. The higher court in Schleswig, which is regionally the one that will decide on Puigdemont, is high, as far as I'm concerned and my German lawyer friends are concerned, highly unlikely to use treason, which is the only paragraph in the German criminal justice book which would allow him to be extradited. We haven't used it in Germany for however many years. We certainly won't use it on someone who, after all, treason is necessarily connected with violence. Where the hell is the violence? Sorry.
Joy, the protests that there were, how significant one way or the other were they? Because it was crowd in Barcelona was estimated at about 50,000 odd. Mm. And that's less than you get at the Nou Camp for a Barcelona home game. Is it possible that the appetite for Mr. Puigdemont's shenanigans is dwindling somewhat in Catalonia?
Actually, I don't know what's going on in the ground there. It seemed to be rather finely split when those protests were going on. And in fact, it was incredibly divisive because you suddenly had neighbour turning on neighbour and a kind of question of, you know, who was actually trying to undermine the nation, who was trying to undermine independence. Does it matter from now on in? Well, yes, it does, because Catalan is pretty much the richest region in Spain. And there's all these questions again about having to leave the EU, were independence to go ahead. So nobody seems to have kind of quite faced these. We're in the kind of Brexit state of mind. We're in the Scotland independence referendum state of mind, where there's a kind of magical thinking about the idea of independence and harsh realities that keep being shown up. However, as long as you start issuing arrest warrants, I think people's idea of the kind of their brothers and sisters not being arrested could, in fact, become rather stronger, and there will be a kind of a circling round of the Catalans to look after him.
Well, moving seamlessly along on the subject of magical thinking about independence not being thought all the way through, it is a year ago tomorrow, I think, not today, tomorrow.
That depends. It could be the day after tomorrow when you look at it from the continent of Europe, because it'll be 0 hundred hours of the 30th of March.
Have we decided which time
zone
this is happening
in? Well, I certainly
in?
Work on the 30th of March. I beg your pardon, but you here in Britain may talk
okay,
about
so we
the 29th.
So nobody's yet even agreed on what date Britain
yes,
invoked Article 50.
It will be the 29th, 11 p.m. here.
And we've
and
had a year to work on that.
Midnight in Brussels and Paris and Berlin.
Well, anyway, it yes. was
Sorry.
More or less a year ago tomorrow that the United Kingdom invoked Article 50 of the Lisbon Treaty, formally notifying the European Union of its intention to leave. Progress since could only be described as frictionless by people who had never learned any other adjectives. Nobody, up to and including the country's government, appears much the wiser about what life will be like once the UK eventually leaves, except that the passports will be blue, although made by a Franco-Dutch company. An exciting new definition of the Pyrrhic victory, to use a daringly continental phrase. Joy, As the only citizen of the United Kingdom at this table, how would you say this is all going so far?
Well, it's going swimmingly, isn't it? I mean, it's just absolutely marvellous.
Swimmingly is another adjective that you could not apply to this.
The poor British public, I mean, had they been told, not, you know, the benefits of leave or the benefits remain, but the fact that they would actually be churning through what is going to be end up being about 5 years' worth of news about intense EU negotiations, which the terminology is completely arcane.
I said at the time, this is what Remain should have led with. They should have said, this is going to be so dull.
This is going to be front page news over and over. You won't know what they're talking about. They're going to start talking about sort of things like customs unions and how they differ from single market.
It's going to go on for years, and it is going to be unremitting. excruciatingly tedious.
So it is in one set of in one lens, it is going quite well because the EU, when they sit down to meet and they draw up what they want to do next, they tend to just do it. Theresa May and David Davis and Ollie Robbins put up a little bit of resistance, but lo and behold, the UK just keeps caving in at the negotiating table purely to get the process along, purely because Theresa May has started her Article 50 gun a little bit early and knows that she has to achieve a certain number of things by the end of it. So, in fact, the EU is sitting there thinking, well, it's all going to our plan absolutely fine.
And
well,
then, she wasted 3 months of the election, which didn't help anyone either.
We shall get to that shortly. But, Sebastian, speaking on behalf of the entire continent of Europe, is this going any more swimmingly from the EU perspective? Well, or is everybody just still completely confused about what Britain thinks it's doing?
Yeah, I think they are fairly confused. They are also still extraordinarily united on what they want to achieve. It's clear that the date, I mean, to be fair to Theresa May, I think that the date was partly, of course, suggested by Brussels because we'll have a new European Parliament election in June of next year, and then a new commission. So in a way, it is a good idea to get everything, at least the main Brexit thing, over and done with by then. Also, I mean, I think a lot of people are losing interest to some extent. They just think, well, it seems now fairly clear that the much vaunted no deal is better than a bad deal mantra has gone out the window, and we will come to a solution. And I would also say, you know, yes, it's true that mainly the Commission agenda has been followed, but there were certain I wouldn't call them victories, but there were some points on which the British government got through as well, didn't it?
Could you name one?
Yeah, well, I was just wondering. While I talked about it.
And no Googling the Daily Express, yeah. Sebastian, name one.
I think we got to sort of stay. What was it? We got a say in fishing quotas for the extra year we're hanging around, and that's about it.
That's
and
awkward.
Even that is causing a furore, and that is 0.5 or even 0.05% of our economy.
0.05, yes.
Yeah. There or thereabouts. Joy, Sebastian mentioned last year's somewhat self-sabotaging election call by Theresa May. Now, the thing that people, I think, do forget is that with the information she had at the time she called the election, it was a no-brainer. She expected to win by miles, as did literally everybody else.
David Cameron expected to win the referendum by miles.
Indeed so, and Hillary Clinton expected to win the US presidency by miles, which we will also come to. But if that election had gone to plan, though, would things really be now any different? Supposing Theresa May was negotiating with a 100-seat majority behind
yes.
her.
It
would be on one particular ground, which is Northern Ireland would be, I think, further down the line of solution than it is at the moment, because everything, you know...
The
border thing would still be a thing, but you wouldn't be actually having to argue with the DUP in the background as well along the way. And I think Northern Ireland has now become such a kind of tension point. And in fact, people who really know Northern Ireland, people like Jonathan Powell, Tony Blair's former advisor, could see this before even the referendum was held. So she's now having to kind of prop up her own government with the DUP, who have very strong ideas about the idea that Northern Ireland cannot be treated in a separate way from the rest of the UK. So it cannot have its own
from abortion and
yeah,
and
apart from that,
but when it suits them.
Except yes, when it, but it cannot exactly. have a it cannot have a sort of special status, and therefore that's why they're having problems trying to work out the border solution. Because if you just gave it a special status and said we'll just technically put this within the customs union or our customs union, the same as theirs, it would get sorted out. But the DUP wouldn't allow that.
Sebastian, what's your sense of what the EU's end game is? And you're right in pointing out that the rest of the EU has remained remarkably cohesive and united on this. Do you get the sense, and this is certainly the sense I get, they're trying to lull Britain into a situation whereby this vaunted transition period may end up lasting quite a while, like possibly until, you know, the Earth spins into the sun and the heat death of the universe?
Now, look, I mean, to go back to the election, I think we are better off with this parliament because Theresa May's very hard Brexit course necessarily had to soften. Ireland is one problem, I agree, but on other ways she has had to give ground. Europe, I think, would be very happy if the transition phase would go on for longer. On the other hand, I think what the EU is trying to do is giving Theresa May space. I think they've taken the strategic decision that they want her to be in charge. They don't want to push her too hard, because they would run the risk of a hard Brexiteer coming in, a harder Brexiteer. And so I think they will push her, but not to an extent where she keels over. And whatever, you know, whatever solution is any close solution is good. A customs union that Labour is talking about, staying in the single market, everything fine, I think, from a European perspective. Anything that doesn't cause terrible friction in the very close relations, just in time, lots of companies having all sorts of supply chains through the whole continent. It would be a disaster for everybody, not just for Britain.
Joy, just a quick final thought on this. Do you get the sense that the real hardcore that Sebastian alluded to there, the no-deal, all-out Brexiteer headbangers, have been successfully marginalised?
I think they have, actually. There was one very interesting thing that Theresa May said in PMQs today, Prime Minister's Questions. It was a question about the vote leave claims, and these are the claims that money was being moved. This relates to Cambridge Analytica. Money was being moved around into places it shouldn't have been moved. And she said it was right that that those claims should be investigated by the police. Now, that diverged is quite significantly from Boris Johnson, who's sort of come out saying this is all completely ridiculous. But you realise at that point she actually has some strength and command in her party, and if vote leave is proven to have defrauded, but essentially defrauded things, she gets a stronger hand in just negotiating a Brexit that the country wanted, but not those particular hard Brexiteers wanted.
Okay, we're going to take a short break now. You are listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, along with Joy Lodico and Sebastian Borger. Coming up next, analysis of Analytica.
Monocle's April edition kicks off in a golf buggy in Indonesia, where President Joko Widodo takes us on a tour of the palace grounds and talks hardline groups, upcoming elections, and wanting to create 10 new Barleys. As our biannual fashion and retail special, it's also one of the sleekest issues of the year. We sit down with Angela Arendts, Senior Vice President of Retail at Apple Inc., to discuss how Apple stores can remedy our growing sense of isolation and profile the bricks and mortar players shaking things up in our retail survey. Our Style Top 50 counts down the brands and looks to covet this spring, plus laments the frayed fortunes of US clothing manufacturers. Elsewhere, we sing the praises of Canary Island wine, visit Dakar's burgeoning art scene, and check out the best in Scandi design at the Stockholm Furniture and Lighting Fair. Plus, we make merry with the glassblowers and woodbenders in the Czech Republic. Monocle's April issue is out now. Do get your copy or subscribe at monocle.com.
And you're back with Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me are Joy Lodico and Sebastian Borger. Now, when considering both Brexit and its approximate transatlantic equivalent, the election to the presidency of Donald Trump, there would be a certain amount of reassurance to be extracted from any revelation that neither was an honest reflection of the feelings of either electorate. It's hard to know, therefore, whether people are seizing upon the Cambridge Analytica revelations principally with outrage or relief. Company whistleblower Chris Wiley, Cambridge Analytica's former director of research, has claimed that the company's illegal mining of Facebook data may have altered the outcome of both elections. Joy, does this sound plausible to you, or is he sort of bigging up his future book advance?
Well, I take a issue with a line you've just said, that these elections were not a reflection of an honest feeling of the electorate. May not have been. There is no reason to suggest that the electorate did not vote the way they felt was the right way based on advertising they had seen. It's more about who took advantage of the ability to advertise to various people. That's not to say this country, in fact, wasn't sort of 60% Brexiteer, but in fact, Cambridge Analytica and Co. didn't do a good enough job at reaching those other people. There is a serious problem with Cambridge Analytica, and it is about privacy and data and a kind of intrusion into people's lives, which they hadn't expected. But there is quite a fierce argument to be had about whether, in fact, it is they who are corrupt, it is the people who've paid them who are corrupt, or whether it is we who are idiots for actually having allowed this all to happen.
Well, this is always what I end up wondering, regardless, Sebastian, of rules, regulations governing political advertising. At the end of all of it, a sentient being walks into a booth with a pencil and makes a cross next to their, near the candidate or referendum choice that they have decided is the appropriate one. It's not really the company's fault if people can't tell false advertising from the real stuff, is it?
Well, it that goes deep into the question of business ethics, doesn't it? And yes, as to some extent, I suppose capitalism is built on profit, and therefore ethical concerns taking a second or indeed a third tier importance. Can I just first of all say, I mean, Wiley, interestingly, I thought in his testimony to the media select committee, talked a lot about the manipulation of many other elections, namely elections in what he called developing countries who are struggling to uphold their fledgling democracy. He mentioned Nigeria, he mentioned Kenya. I think there's talk about St. Kitts and Nevis in the Caribbean as well. And he talked about the new colonialism, which I thought was fascinating, that Western companies of whatever persuasion should come in and try to manipulate, in that case, with really highly unethical methods, basically producing compromise by entrapping people in bribery allegations and all that, and thereby actually having swayed some elections. As far as the Trump election is concerned, of course, there was a press release by Cambridge Analytica 2 days afterwards saying, we did it. That's what it basically said. Well, and when you then followed up on that, I didn't personally, but other colleagues had spoken to both the Carson and the Cruz campaign, both, of course, who had been beaten by Trump in the Republican nomination runoff, who both had dealings with Cambridge Analytica, and both of their campaigns said, "Well, these guys know how to sell a deal, but they certain as hell didn't deliver for us."
Joy, Cambridge Analytica did work for President Uhuru Kenyatta, as he still is in Kenya, but Kenya's Supreme Court cancelled their presidential election last year because they said it was hooky, and then re-ran it, admittedly with very little in the way of opposition and more or less the same result. But hypothetically, if shenanigans are confirmed to have occurred, is there ever any reason for actually calling back an election? And even if there is, would that be politically possible?
Well, that's a wonderful question.
I do my best.
I think you...
You're the upholder of the rule of law. Come on, say yes. Say yes.
I should at that point say yes, but I almost think at that point it sort of unleashes the genie. It's a sort of matter of total chaos. In elections, I would say you have to go and fight the next battle and you have to make sure that doesn't happen again. In referendums, it's a little bit more tricky because you're not going to get another referendum.
Indeed not.
I would still then go back to my just slightly cynical point about the Cambridge Analytica scandal, which is it was very good marketing. It was excellent marketing, and we are complaining bitterly about one side having hired much better marketers than the other. The misuse of data at the basis of it is illegal, but it is about who won and who lost those elections and who's arguing from which side.
Basically, you're saying you don't think voters can be led anywhere they didn't really want to go?
Let me put it this way. I think if you went to go and have a look at the Labour Party's data-gathering machines for the last election, you would find that some very, very sophisticated software, again, doing essentially micro-targeting. And as I understood it, they could almost get it down. This may be a journalist writing about it rather than what was the actuality. Pretty much down to one person. They could actually find that one person. And kind of questions about picking up an opinion on a doorstep rather than on Facebook and suddenly stick it into their marketing systems. Now, there's all sorts of shenanigans that go on in elections. You know, just have to clean them up for the next one.
Well, finally tonight to the United States, which in 2020 is due to conduct a census, that exercise by which a nation seeks to calculate the precise number of people who are complaining that its government doesn't do enough for them while whinging that their taxes are too high. The US Department of Commerce, which oversees the census, has announced that for the first time since 1950, the 2020 census will include a question on citizenship. This is generating a measure of uproar. The Attorney General of California, for one, already filing suit, calling it an attempt to bully immigrant communities. Sebastian, I noticed because I checked that the 2011 UK census didn't ask about citizenship directly, but did ask what passports you hold, which is basically the same question. It's a fair enough question for a census to ask, isn't it?
To be honest, I think it is, yes. And I can't quite... I'm not au fait with all the rules, but I can't quite understand the argument which says if you ask an illegal immigrant as to whether or not he's got the right passport, then he won't or she won't reply. Well, if they are illegal, you can't ask them in the first place, can you? I don't quite get it.
Well, the census form is delivered to every address, regardless of whether the person living there is legally at it or not.
Okay, and then do you seriously expect them to answer?
You may have spotted the flaw in the plan.
I can't see the problem.
So there's the good reason for having all this is apparently about fund allocation and making sure voter engagement in all different sectors of society. There is a sort of slightly dark side. So this whole thing has been put forward by Wilbur Ross, the Commerce Secretary. If you go back to last year, Trump said that in addition to winning the Electoral College by a landslide, I won the popular vote if you deduct the millions of people who voted illegally.
And in much the same way that this is literally the most listened to radio program in the world, if you take away all the people who don't listen to it.
Now, the thing about Trump is that he doesn't tend to pull
these... If you add all the people who don't listen to it.
If you actually look at what Trump does, he's actually borrowing information from somewhere. And what he was doing was borrowing some information from a study by Rickman Ernest, which was quoted in the Washington Post blog, which actually said there probably were about, you know, several million people who did vote illegally, but not necessarily deliberately so. What happens is that you fill in forms at state level and you just accidentally tick the wrong box or the state bureaucracies just don't really fill it in properly. And it goes up to the federal level for elections. And at that point, you're just suddenly entitled to a vote, even though
without actually technically being
an American citizen.
Right.
So this is kind of corrective on that.
Mm.
I'm not sure whether that study is correct or not, but it's perfectly possible because, you know, I'm hopeless at filling out paperwork. Trump, of course, turns it into the word illegally, and it's very strong. And this is a way of kind of trying to measure who should be voting and get those exact numbers so that come the next election, you can't get 6 million extra votes going to Hillary.
All right, Sebastian, is there a limit on what the government is entitled to ask in a census form? The UK census form in 2011 also included a question, for example, on how well you spoke English.
We had a fascinating debate about that in Germany 35 years ago, you know, where people were complaining about how intrusive these census forms were. Now, of course, Germany has a particular history with intrusive governments and so is maybe particularly sensitive. You can always look at these questions in two ways, can't you? I mean, in the British example, obviously what you assume and hope the government to want to do is find out how many people cannot actually participate in everyday life for which they do need to know English. If the government at the same time cuts down funding on English language courses as the coalition and then the conservative government has done since 2010, then you start to worry what that question was about, obviously.
Well, that does bring us to the end of today's show. Sebastian Borger and Joy Lodico, thanks very much both for joining us at Midori House. It was produced by Carlotta Rebello, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Pierre-Antoine Denis. Our studio manager was David Stevens. Music next at 1900, it's The Entrepreneurs. More on the day's main stories on The Daily at 2200. Midori House returns at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London. I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks for listening.